Lecture 2, Making Tanakh.
The story of the Bible begins not with Christians, but with Jews. In fact, it begins with the ancient Israelite people whose story the Bible first relates. This presentation takes up the formation of the Jewish Bible, whose proper name within the Jewish tradition is Tanakh. Tanakh is an acronym made up of three capital letters, T, N, K, joined by the vowel A, and the three letters stand for, respectively, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. The meaning of these terms will become clear in the course of this presentation. But the Hebrew Bible, or Tanakh, is the literature of an ancient people that was composed over a long period of time in circumstances that are not entirely clear. Now, I must begin with a clarification with regard to this statement about human authorship over a long period of time. It is the case that within traditional Judaism and Christianity, the writings of the Bible or sacred scripture are regarded as divinely inspired. And yet, this notion of divine inspiration is fully compatible with the understanding that it was real human beings in real human circumstances that composed these writings. In this respect, Christianity and Judaism alike are distinct from Islam. In Islam, the Quran is regarded as a literal revelation in Arabic from the angel Gabriel to the prophet Muhammad. And that is why the Arabic version of the Quran is literally Allah's word, and why the Quran has a sacred quality only in Arabic. In Judaism and Christianity, the situation is quite different. The tradition recognizes it is the law that is given through Moses. It is the Psalms written by David. It is the wisdom of Solomon. Similarly, in the New Testament, it is the good news or the gospel according to Mark or John or Matthew. The letters of the New Testament are letters written by Paul or by Peter. In other words, the compositions of the Bible are recognized both within Judaism and Christianity as coming from real people in real historical circumstances. The ascription of divine inspiration, then, is not, within these traditions, a theory of literary composition, but rather an ascription of authority, the recognition that through these human compositions, God was at work, and that these compositions are recognized as having distinctive, even divine authority backing them. If the Bible is eternal, therefore, in Judaism and Christianity, it is within the context of genuine temporality. Notice that both within Judaism and Christianity, in contrast to Islam, the Bible remains the Bible even in translation. The Bible is not the holy book only in Hebrew or only in Greek, but it is the Bible and the holy Bible in whatever language it appears. So within these traditions, there is the recognition of human authorship, but discovering the human origins of the Bible is not altogether easy, and it requires the piecing together of several kinds of evidence and a certain amount of controlled speculation. There are basically three kinds of evidence that scholars use when trying to figure out how to reconstruct the origin of these compositions. The first is the texts themselves, with respect to their internal composition and their external references. When we look at biblical compositions, do they suggest that perhaps they are not made up of a single layer, but perhaps layers of tradition that we can distinguish? That's one way of getting at this. Another way is by saying, what are they talking about in the outside world? What do they make reference to? So by looking at what stories the Bible talks about, what historical events, and so forth, as well as its internal composition, we can make certain guesses as to its point of origin. A second form of evidence of limited but real significance is archaeology. Archaeology is a science that, to a remarkable extent, has grown up together with biblical studies, and especially because the ancient Near East is such a wonderful place in which to carry out archaeological investigations. And so digging in the dirt and recovering literally layers of tradition helps, again, locate biblical compositions in history. Finally, the third kind of evidence is the way in which we can correlate or compare biblical materials with those materials of the literature of the other great Near Eastern cultures, as in Egypt or Sumeria and so forth. Sort of cross-cultural comparative, literary comparison. But even when all of these forms of evidence are taken into account, the reconstruction of the origins of the Hebrew Bible is highly speculative and therefore much disputed among scholars. Now, here are some general statements concerning the origins of the Hebrew Bible that everybody acknowledges. First, its contents came into being as the literature of a formerly nomadic people. In the book of Joshua, chapter 24, the most ancient confession of belief in the Hebrew Bible begins, "A wandering Aramean was my father." This was a people that had its origins in a nomadic existence, but then came to occupy the tiny strip of contested land known either as Palestine or within the tradition as Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, that sat uneasily between the ancient empires. To the east, the successive empires of Sumeria, Babylon, Assyria, Persia, and Parthia. And to the west, the constant, unchanging empire of Egypt. This tiny strip of land on which the Israelite people lived was at once insignificant and critical for anybody who had imperial ambitions. And so, even in its short period of time, for a period of several hundred years, when there was a genuine monarchy in ancient Israel, a sovereignty, it was largely dependent on the will of the competing empires to the east and to the west, a situation not that dissimilar from more recent history. And the Bible reflects interaction, then, with several stages of ancient Near Eastern culture and historical development, which can especially be traced in the books of Samuel and the books of Kings. The original language of the Bible was Hebrew. It is a distinctive consonantal language. The words are basically consonants, not vowels, in its original form. And Hebrew has cognates with a number of other ancient Near Eastern languages, such as Ugaritic. Hebrew is written from right to left, from top to bottom, and it is based upon a three-letter triliteral root. And changes in words, and therefore in meaning, are morphological. That is, words take on different meaning as things, letters are added either at the beginning by way of prefix or at the end by way of suffix. But in the original writings, this is all a matter of consonants. Now, this is itself a fascinating reflection on the circumstances of writing and its relationship with oral culture. Because the only way in which one knew how to sound the consonantal letters was by knowing how they should be sounded. In other words, the vowel sounds were handed on by oral tradition until a certain point in history, which we will describe. So at one level, the ancient Hebrew could be called a form of code or a form of shorthand that was intelligible only within the context of an oral culture. The only exception to the Hebrew character of the Jewish Bible is the second half of the book of Daniel, which is composed in Aramaic, a more recent dialect of classical Hebrew. As I've suggested, the process by which biblical compositions came into being involved both oral and written practices. Oral performance is most obvious in the prophetic literature. The prophets are full of statements such as, "The word of the Lord came to Isaiah," or Amos says, "Thus says the Lord." It is a form of oral proclamation carried out largely in the context of the court. The other place where oral performance is obvious is in the Psalms, which are filled with first-person language. "To you, O Lord, I call," in Psalm 28:11, or "Hear my prayer, O Lord," in Psalm 102:1. And yet we know at some point these oral performances that took place in the temple in prayer were written down, thus the Psalms written by David. And at some point these oral performances of the prophets were written down, thus we have the books of the prophets. And even within those books there are references to sayings of the prophets written in books, so that the oral and written aspects of the biblical materials are complexly interwoven. The oral aspect of the Bible can be seen also in the great written narratives, the story of the patriarchs, for example, or the story of the Exodus and the conquest. These also may well have begun as oral recitations in the manner of the folklore of other peoples, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, or the Scandinavian Eddas. Now, what about the writing aspect then? The creation of literature presupposes certain social settings and technical capabilities. As in other ancient Near Eastern cultures, Israel developed a class of scribes, a scribal class whose writing capabilities served both the court and the temple. Reading and writing, remember, in antiquity was a remarkably rare phenomenon. And so the ability to read and write was, first of all, a professional skill, which required both training and equipment. And this was mostly to be found in the context of a bureaucracy, of a court bureaucracy. And the most obvious times when such activity could be carried out within Israel in conditions of reasonable stability were the periods following the establishment of the court and temple by Solomon in the 10th and 9th century, and the period after the exile in the 6th and 5th century, when a more modest version of court and temple were established. And it is the tendency of scholars to assign periods of written composition to these points in the chronology when there were the social conditions that enabled such writing to take place. Let's turn to the contents of the Hebrew Bible. The most authoritative part of the Hebrew Bible is called Torah. The word Torah is rich in meaning and connotation, which we will see in our next presentation. But at root, it means something like instruction or teaching. And the fact that the five books of Moses are called Torah by Jews indicates something of what they think is important in those books. The story is less important than the instruction given by those stories. Now, many Christians know the five books of Moses by the term Pentateuch, which simply means fivefold. We should be reminded that the names of biblical books generally in English derive from the Greek translation of the Hebrew more than they do come directly from the Hebrew designations. And so I will give both the Hebrew and the Greek designations translated into English, which are more familiar to us. Now, although religious tradition ascribes these five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, to the prophet and lawgiver Moses, who lived in the 13th century before the Common Era and had led the people out of Egypt, since the Enlightenment, scholars have unanimously agreed that the composition of these five books involve a more complex process that took place over a considerable period of time. This is one of the ways in which a traditional understanding of authorship and a more critical scholarly understanding of authorship come to quite different conclusions. 19th century source criticism of the Pentateuch observed several features of these five books that called out for explanation, such as doublets and different designations for God. Let me talk a little bit about each of those. As we read the stories in the books of Moses, we see sometimes that the same story seems to be told twice. These are called doublets. So, for example, in Genesis 1, we have a creation account in which God creates everything simply by a word, including male and female in the image of God. But then in chapter 2 of Genesis, there is quite a distinct creation account in which God creates first the male and then creates the female out of the rib of the male, with no mention about being made in the image of God. So there are two creation accounts. Similarly, in Genesis 6 and 7, there seem to be two versions of Noah and the flood story that are interwoven, creating certain inconsistencies within the story. Or in Genesis 12, 1 to 20, we see that Abraham, with his wife Sarah, goes to Egypt, and out of fear that his wife will be taken away from him, he asks Sarah to say that she is his sister. 14 chapters later, in Genesis 26, 6 to 11, we see Isaac, with his wife Rebekah, going into the land of the Philistines, and out of fear, he asks his wife to say, "I am his sister," rather than his wife. And so these are called doublets and call out for explanation. Similarly, different parts of the story use different designations consistently for God. In some, the name Yahweh, the sacred tetragrammaton, is used. In others, the Hebrew term Elohim, a more generic term for God, is used. And sometimes there seems to be a conflation, that is, the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, is used. How do we account for these? Although the precise delineation of the sources is debated, many scholars perceive four distinct sources for the five books of Moses, which are called the Yahwist, the Elohist, the Deuteronomist, and the priestly sources. Even more vigorously debated is the assignment of distinct periods of composition according to the supposed outlook of these sources. The Yahwist and the Elohist are taken to be the oldest sources, perhaps in the 10th and 9th century before the Common Era, with the South Kingdom being represented by the Yahwist and the Northern Kingdom being represented by the Elohist. And then the Deuteronomist as a reform voice of the 6th century that not only accounts for the book of Deuteronomy, but also stamps the entire history from Joshua through Kings with its distinctive reformist outlook. And then the priestly editor coming at the end, very much concerned with genealogies, with the laws for sacrifice, with the temple, with what is clean and unclean. Now, according to this understanding, then, the oldest parts of the book of of Moses would come from the 10th century, from the Yahwist, and the newest parts of it would have been written last in the 5th century, perhaps, by a priestly editor. And according to this reading, the very first part of Genesis, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, would have been the last written. It would have been written by the priestly editor to begin the whole. Now, all of this is highly debated by scholars and needs to be supplemented by other considerations, such as oral tradition, such as other forms of rhetoric and so forth available in antiquity. But the basic point is that the five books of Moses came into being over a long period of time through a complex process. In terms of content, the five books of Moses provide the grand narrative of the formation of Israel as a people and the terms of its covenant with God. After the account of creation and the legends of the fall in Genesis 1 through 11, the stories of the patriarchs from Abraham to Joseph dominate in chapters 12 through 50. If Abraham was a historical figure, as he may well have been, he would have lived around the year 1800 before the Common Era. This first book is called in Hebrew Breshit, Beginnings. The Exodus, or in Hebrew Shemot, which means names, describes the enslavement of Israel in Egypt, the call of Moses, and the plagues that come upon Egypt, the deliverance of the people from bondage, and the giving of the law through Moses, climaxing in the description of the tent for worship in the wilderness. Now, I want to make a point here that for Jewish readers, it is not the story of the Exodus is important, but it is prelude to the making of covenant and to the giving of the law. This is really the heart of the story, the instruction, Torah. So the third book, Leviticus in Greek, or Vayikra in Hebrew, he called, continues the legislation given to the people through Moses, with particular attention given to the practices of worship, especially sacrifice. The fourth book of Moses, Bamidbar, in the desert, or Numbers in Greek, recounts the events of the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness under the leadership of Moses, including the rebellion of the people and the mighty works of God. The fifth book of Moses, Deuteronomy, in Greek means second law. In Hebrew, it is called Devarim, words, very appropriately, because Deuteronomy consists in long discourses, really sermons, delivered to the people by Moses before they enter the land of Canaan, summoning them to obedience and describing the blessings that come with obedience to the covenant and the curses that come with disobedience. So these are the five books of Moses that are called within the Jewish tradition Torah, thus the first letter of the term Tanakh. The second portion of the Jewish Bible is made up of the prophets. In Hebrew, the word for prophet is Nabi, and in the plural, Nevi'im. These are 21 writings that make up the second portion of the Bible. The prophets are broken into two categories, the former prophets, or the earlier prophets, and the latter prophets. For those who are not within the Jewish tradition, it may come as a surprise that the earlier or former prophets are actually made up of six narrative books that continue the story of the people from the time they entered into the land of Canaan around the year 1200, such as Joshua, Judges, and then 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, which cover the period of time between the 10th and 6th centuries. The Jewish Bible counts as the latter prophets, those spokespersons for God to the people, with the term major prophets referring to the books of Isaiah in the 8th century, Jeremiah in the 7th century, and Ezekiel in the 6th century. The Jewish Bible refers to a collection of 12 books as the minor prophets. Now, this is not a term of denigration, as though they weren't important, but simply a reference to their length. They are much shorter than the books of Isaiah, Jeremiah, or Ezekiel. And one of the reasons why Isaiah may be so long is that it is quite possible that it is itself made up of three separate prophetic traditions, the historical Isaiah, and then second Isaiah, and third Isaiah. The 12 minor prophets are the books of Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Finally, the 13 writings that make up the final and least internally organized portion of the Jewish Bible are called simply writings, ketuvim. These are the compositions that had the hardest time getting in, as we will see. Five of these writings are called by an ancient designation, Megillot, which simply means scrolls. The Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, or in Hebrew, Kohelet, and the Book of Esther. These are called the scrolls, apparently, because they were read out loud in liturgical celebrations. So, for example, even today in the Jewish synagogue, the Book of Esther is read on the Feast of Purim, because the Book of Esther really recounts the origins of Purim. A second loose grouping among the writings contains the Psalms, Proverbs, and the Book of Job. These also can be roughly thought of as wisdom literature. And the final group of the writings again takes up issues of Jewish history. First and Second Chronicles, which is really a priestly version of the first and second books of Kings. It covers exactly the same chronological period, but with a slightly different perspective. And then books written after the exile in 537 following Ezra, Nehemiah, and the book of Daniel. So the five books of Moses, the 21 books of the prophets, and the 13 writings make up 39 compositions in the Hebrew or Jewish Bible. Now, the most remarkable aspect of this variegated literature is that in each of its parts and as a whole, it imagines a world which is at once astonishing and coherent. I've been fond of saying that the Bible does not so much describe the world as imagine a world, because it really does imagine a world which is in every respect created by and answerable to a character off stage, namely God. God creates, He calls, God commands, God guides, God saves, God rewards, God punishes. God is the most active presence in every book of the Hebrew Bible, with the exception of the Song of Solomon and the book of Esther, in which God is not mentioned. Although written by many people then, across many centuries, and although it does have internal points of disagreement, you could not get the same form of wisdom from the book of Proverbs and Kohelet. They have quite distinct perspectives on what is important. Nevertheless, the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish Bible, does speak with one voice in this fundamental sense of the word, that it is God intoxicated. It views the world totally from the perspective of the God who has created all things and toward whom all things are ordered. Reading through this book, then, really is like traveling in a foreign land. Not only because it was written long ago and far away and in a different language, but because its premises about how the world works, the culture, if you will, of the Bible, how the world works, or perhaps better, who runs the world, is so different than the one in which many of us spend most of our time. This is at once the great charm and attraction of the Bible, and for many, also its greatest weakness.